Save It for the Blind is sponsored by Tetra Hearing. Tetra Hearing isn't just hearing protection, it's hearing perfection. Kershaw Knives. Kershaw manufactures next-level pocket knives for outdoor enthusiasts. Save for the Blind is now also being sponsored by Roseville Motorsports. Roseville Motorsports is the greater Sacramento area's premier destination for all your power sports vehicle needs. Stop in today to browse off-road vehicles from leading manufacturers like Polaris, Yamaha, and more. Rig 'em Right, heavily seasoned gear for the die-hard waterfowl hunter. If you guys are enjoying the show, we'd love to hear from you and get your support. Please follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Give us a 5-star rating. Your reviews really help us grow and reach more people. Thank you for being a part of our community.
We're like during the course of a filming season, like how many days were you actually back at home?
I would be gone at least half the time, but I'm replacing me on a number of places other than but I also have to do all the logistics. I book the hotels, talk to the people about the ranch show and the fishing show and all the other shows. So
so you're phasing yourself out, but you're still in it full bore.
Well, I'd like to get a piece of it for a while.
But that's very true.
I'm kind of tired of booking travel and all that other crap.
I could see how that would get old after many, many years of doing it.
Well, and we have a fifth series that'll start in 26. And so you figure that's 40 episodes a year that we have to do for TV. Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
Now, are you coming up with these ideas for the other shows, or is that coming down from the networks? How does that work?
The Dead Meat Show, actually, they asked me to host many years ago. And then the Fishmonger Show is with a guy that I've worked with at one of the consumer shows in Southern California for years. Based on the success of the Fishmonger Show, which is all about the challenges facing the commercial fishing industry and how 90% of the seafood that we eat is imported. We did Ranch America, and there's a host, the guy owns a couple of restaurants up in Murphy's. He's got 80 or 90 head of cattle. He's a cowboy, rancher, restaurateur, and he's hosting that. And, we've got non-traditional TV hosts. We don't have people that have always wanted to be on TV. As a matter of fact, including myself, nobody ever planned on being on TV. So it's a little more natural.
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. Wild. So I want to welcome everyone back to another episode of Save It for the Blind. I'm Jeff Smith here with my partner, Carson Odegaard, and we have a world-famous chef, Scott Lasath, who is from Folsom, also known as the Sporting Chef. So if you've read DU Magazine, California Waterfowl, been around the internet, YouTube, Outdoor Channel, you've probably seen Scott's shows. There's many of them, books, etc. But I know a couple personal friends that attributed some of your cooking recipes to their continued waterfowl hunting career because they were having such a hard time cooking the ducks to taste good for their family. And they've told me that you're an inspiration to them continuing to hunt because their wife actually liked their cooking after they used some of your recipes. I do remember it was a while back, but we did a TV show at a Grizzly Ranch, and guys were bringing back spoonies and teal, et cetera, and you were cooking stuff up for appetizers with like the most simple ingredients. And I was like, what are you doing? You're like, oh, just a little salt and pepper, a little olive oil. I was like, I've never once ever had something taste this good by using just like simple ingredients that the normal person could do. So I want to say thank you so much for joining us today. We are excited to talk about your career and what hunters can do and anglers can do to help better their table fare. But just first start off, I mean, just kind of talk to us how you got down into the road of wild game cooking, being a famous chef, and kind of what evolved in your career.
You know, my inspiration, I think, was my dad. I would duck hunt with my dad. He was an Alabama farm boy, and he would take ducks and cram them with apples and oranges and rice and all sorts of stuff, and then cook the snot out of them until they were gray and tasted really, really bad. And I'm thinking, I really like shooting ducks, but these guys do not taste good. So I basically just simplified it. I broke them down. I cooked the breast separate from the legs. And when I had a restaurant in Freeport, California, we'd have game on the menu. And people would say, how come my game doesn't taste like yours? And I'd say, bring it in. And so we would cook people's fish and game for them. And then my partner and I at Silver Sage Caterers, which I know is owned by a different group now that you guys use fairly often in your banquets.
Yeah.
We did our first wild game feed for CWA at the Machinist's Hall in Rancho Cordova, I don't know, 28 years ago. How long? When was the first game feed? It was about that long ago. So, you know, mine is not a well-planned career path. I have a degree in psychology. I realized I really didn't like people whining all that much. So when I was finishing up school, I was working as a bouncer, and they said, hey, you want to be a manager? The next thing you know, the president of a 33-unit chain, the Bear in Chico, the Madison Bear Garden.
We're both Chico State grads, so very well aware of the Bear.
Staple.
Back in the old days in Madison Bear, I got there in August 79, so I'm guessing I might have predated you guys just a little bit.
A few years. It's still there.
It wasn't doing well then, so they brought me in to kind of pick it up, and I said, well, we need to do a wet t-shirt contest. And that was the first and last wet t-shirt contest at the Bear. One night we did 140 bottles of Jack Daniels. Our best month in May was 550 kegs.
Oh, wow.
That was when Chico was a little different with Pioneer Week and all that.
Oh, yeah.
Nuts. So
it's simmered down a little bit since those days. Not as wild.
But you know, we sure had a lot more pheasants then too. So I hunted a lot around Chico and hunted ducks and pheasants. And when I got transferred from Arizona up here, and I got to see there was actually water in the rivers and birds flying around, and I said, I'll be right back with my stuff. And I've been here ever since.
Nice. So how long were you doing that at the Bear?
79 until I opened my own restaurant in 87 in Freeport. But I went from general manager to regional manager to vice president of the chain.
Gotcha.
So the chain was based in LA, and I was able to avoid that by telling them I was working on a house because I wasn't going to move to LA. So it was a race to see whether they could fire me before I opened my own place.
So being a Bear connoisseur, do you know who is a creator of the Jiffy Burger? Is that a thing that you know?
Randy Peters was brought in. He has Randy Peters Catering in Roseville now. They brought him in to kind of redo the whole menu. And, you know, the Bear has always been a pretty straightforward menu. We just had burgers and pretty much burgers. And he came in and upgraded the menu. So the menu that you've seen at the Bear for the last 30 years was an upgrade from the one I started with.
Wow. Did you ever try to do anything with wild game in some of the recipes you had? No.
But you guys remember Burger Madness at the Bear, right? Yeah. I mean, we would do 500 to 600 burgers on Burger Madness night, on Thursday nights, I think. So there would be lines to get inside, lines to get up the stairs. And we had lots of doormen working.
That's wild.
Yeah.
So you open your restaurant, like, how do you get to your first television show? And what was the idea behind getting into filming? Cause probably at that time there wasn't a whole lot of outdoor channel really focused on cooking. Was there?
No, there was, you know, John McGannon, who you guys may or may not know, I know he's done some CWA events, great chef. He had a show on Outdoor Life Network on OLN years ago, but there really wasn't much. When I had the restaurant in Freeport, somebody asked me to be the back of the house chef for an HGTV show called Homegrown Cooking, and I had no idea what was involved in doing a TV show. It was a ton of work. We did 65 shows in 6 weeks.
Wow.
So it was,
holy moly.
Yeah, it was trial by fire. So I did about 185 episodes with them. I ended up, after the first season, being on both sides of the camera, cooking on camera and all that. And then I started on Comcast Sports Southeast with The Sporting Chef, and that was in 2001.
Okay.
So here I am. Go figure.
What's been your favorite part of the traveling and being able to cook lots of different wild game that you probably wouldn't otherwise have the opportunity for it as a California resident?
Well, and I got to tell you, a lot of the game that we cook on the Dead Meat Show, I don't need to ever eat again.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's some pretty nasty stuff out there that people like to eat. And what we try and do is find out what other cultures eat. We like it to be kind of cultural. And, you know, I was on the Texas-Mexico border years ago, and these people had saved me a machita. And a machita is goat heart, liver, and lung wrapped with goat fat, and it's tied together with goat intestines. And it was a little undercooked.
Ooh.
Right. So a lot of people are starting to throw up in their mouth right now. So you've got this warm, undercooked, fatty layer on the outside with the stringy intestines, and then the crunchy undercooked organs in the center. So who wants to eat that twice, right?
that's a special meal right there.
Yeah. That's not the worst of it, but that was kind of funky.
Is there an animal or a fish that you thought in your mind was going to taste a heck of a lot better than just ended up being just something that you didn't prefer?
You know, most of the stuff, it kind of goes the other way, where, you know, for instance, beaver tail soup actually tastes really good. Huh. Are you familiar with hagfish?
No.
All right. Everybody needs to Google hagfish. It is, we're at Avila Beach down by Pismo, and this guy gets 6 to 10,000 pounds of live hagfish and ships it live to Korea. So he takes buckets of fish guts, parts, the worst crap you can imagine, strings them out in the bay around Avila Beach. And then when you go pick them up, it's full of these hagfish. They call them slime eels. They have no eyes, a lamprey-like mouth. They back into the silt under the bottom. And if a fish does eat them, they put out this ungodly amount of slime, which chokes the fish out. Then they eat the fish from the inside out.
Oh, wow.
All you have to do is just agitate them a little bit, and it's like alien quality slime. And I had called, it's a Korean delicacy. So I called two Korean restaurants in Paso Robles and said, will you cook it like they do in Korea? And one guy laughed and then hung up, and the other one just hung up immediately. So when that happens, that means, Scott, you're cooking. So I did kind of a unagi preparation, since it's an eel, freshwater eel type of thing. So I peeled it, cut the heads off, took the guts out, put it in a bucket, put it in the walk-in. They were still moving the next day.
Oh,
we're talking
God.
Skeletons and meat, no organs, no head. But you got, I cannot adequately describe how bad the slime is. They actually are using the slime to make a Kevlar-like material. The boat itself was like a garbage scow, just full of this caked slime. They barf up all the stuff that they ate when you put them on the boat. And I know it sounds really delicious, but maybe it's an acquired taste.
That is wild. So we talked about kind of not most appetizing. What's a wild game dish that you think everybody should try at least once?
You know, I think a perfectly cooked pintail breast with the skin on, that you put it skin side down. I'm talking just salt, pepper, maybe a little bit of olive oil. I like to simplify how we cook our game.
Okay.
What a lot of people try and do, and what historically has been done, is we do everything we can to make our game not taste like game. You know, I think the best example is the jalapeno bacon.
The popper.
Popper. Duck poppers. Yeah.
Which are the first thing to go. I know they taste good. I know they're popular. But, you know, I had a guy tell me that he said snow goose is his favorite waterfowl. Now, I like snow geese. I'd rather eat a snow goose than a Canada goose, usually. He said he cuts it into little strips, marinates it for 48 hours in teriyaki, then wraps it in jalapeno bacon and cream cheese. Now, you could do the same thing with your finger and it would taste about the same, and it's not going to taste like duck or goose anymore. You take that pintail breast, put a little coarse salt, some freshly ground pepper, put it skin side down, low heat, render that fat down, then crank it up so the skin is nice and crispy, flip it over, get it to about 130, 135 degrees, let it rest for a few minutes. To me, it just eats like butter, and it's so, so very good. If it's a little too much for you, you can always brine it, and I'm a big proponent of brining waterfowl. Gallon of water to a cup each of coarse salt and brown sugar is what I use. If you use a commercial brine, like High Mountain Seasoning makes a brine that has a little sodium nitrate in it, and it gives it a different color. It gives it more of a beef-like color. So if you have people that are afraid of the purple-looking game that's been cooked properly, this looks more like beef. It makes it a little more reddish. But brine it, don't overcook it, and don't bury it in some kind of sauce.
When you're brining it, Scott, are you putting it on the stove and putting all the salts and stuff in the brown sugar and dissolving it? Or are you just putting it in a bag and putting it in the fridge and just shaking it up?
Well, if you're using a coarse salt, you normally have to put it in water and dissolve it. And you can just take some of the water, dissolve the salt, and then add it to the rest of the water. Because you want, when you do the brine, you want your water to be chilled, refrigerator temp. And, you know, as little as 6 hours, if you're doing whole birds, which I rarely cook unless it's for a photo, overnight's fine, really. It makes a big difference. What it does is it gets rid of that myoglobin that freaks people out. They go, I don't want a bloody duck. And you explain to them that it's not blood.
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter.
That's me trying to explain to my wife. It's like, that's not blood. It's red. I'm like, yeah, but it's not blood.
Yeah.
I know.
Just got to get over that part of it. But like, was there someone that actually mentored you in getting into the wild game stuff? Or were you just really into cooking and you were a hunter, obviously, and like, I'm going to make a go at this. Was there someone that helped you or books that helped you along? Because now there's a ton of resources out there for people to get into wild game hunting or cooking and all that. But how did you get better at it and how did you start?
You know, I didn't really have a wild game cooking mentor. Like I said, there wasn't a whole lot out there. The L.L. Bean cookbook was probably the Bible at that time. And it was one of the few cookbooks that didn't use cream of mushroom soup or a crock pot. and it talked about how to cook it rare to medium rare for your deer meat and your waterfowl. Most of it, you know, I grew up in, you know, as a chef and a restaurateur, and I knew how to cook. So most of what I did was adapt domestic meat recipes to game. And most of the time, it was just altering the cooking time, because if you cook a pheasant like you cook a chicken, your pheasant's going to be dry and taste bad. And then you'll blame the pheasant. You'll say, oh, no, pheasant's dry.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my pheasant's not dry. My pheasant's, I just don't overcook it.
And how are you not overcooking it? Like, compared to someone cooking a chicken, how would someone alter their cooking style to get the moisture in the pheasant, and what do they need to do?
Well, for instance, with a pheasant, if you brine it first with a low saltwater brine, you let it, and then you just kind of pat it dry. If you've got a meat thermometer, I pull my pheasant out at about 145 to 150, let it rest. People are freaking out, going, no, it's got to be 160, 165. Well, that's a chicken. But start with a meat thermometer. I know what medium rare feels like, just like any other. I mean, A guy working the line in a restaurant is not using a thermometer or cutting a hole into the steak to see what it looks like on the inside.
like I am.
It looks good now.
like most people do. I mean, that restaurant chef knows what medium rare feels like. And again, rare on the, you want to err on the undercooked side because you can always put it back on the stove.
If your
pheasant comes out and it still looks a little undercooked, to me, it's probably going to be fine. But if you want to just throw it back on for another minute, let it rest, you're fine. A little liquid when you're cooking something like pheasant, which, you know, a wild pheasant, which it looks like we're about out of now, obviously doesn't have nearly as much fat as the planted birds, the pen-raised birds, but just, you know, it comes with experience. And it comes with undercooking and then cooking a little bit more. But once you've overcooked it, all is not lost. You can still make soup with it, and it'll be fine.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
What's the most common mistake you see from people, like, when they're preparing their wild game? Is it overcooking? Is that just the plain and simple number one way to ruin wild game?
Well, for instance, I don't cook a whole duck, like I mentioned, because to me, duck legs are best done low and slow. My duck legs take about 3 hours, and after about 3 hours, they'll start to pull off the bone. That's when I take them off, cool them off, and then when I'm cooking the breast, if I'm throwing them on the grill, I'll take those almost perfectly cooked duck legs, throw them on the grill, and then people will say, man, what did you do to these duck legs? When you cook a whole duck, if the breast is medium rare, I don't think the legs are edible. And I, you know, I learned this by doing lots of game dinners. We actually, the Stockton wood duck dinner, is that it? Is there a wood duck dinner? Is
it Stockton? It originated in Stockton and then went to Fairfield, and now it's actually back in Stockton. Yeah.
When Greg Cornell and I, when we were catering that dinner, The guys would go and they'd shoot a couple hundred flighted mallards somewhere up in Ione or something. And we go, what do we do with these legs? So we took all the legs off all of those ducks, did them separately, got them cooked, threw them into a cooler, let them just rest in the cooler while they were nice and hot. Then we cooked the breast and people were just going nuts over these legs. You know, what a lot of people do, a lot of duck hunters do, is they just breast them out and they throw the rest away. Even if you've got the bigger ducks, you know, it's a complete waste. Again, I just don't cook a whole duck. People say the old wisdom was if you put some fruit in there or some herbs or whatever, it draws out all the gamey flavor. I don't believe any of that. It doesn't get past the cavity. Mine doesn't cook that long anyway.
Yeah.
So break your ducks down. Use the bodies for stock. Roast it. Make stock out of it. Cook the legs separately, cook the breast fast and hot, the legs low and slow.
Questions about the legs. Are you keeping skin on the legs or are you going just meat on leg?
It all depends on how good of a year I'm having. If I have a lot of ducks, I might be more prone to peel them. Mm-hmm. Plucked is better than peeled. You know, there's not a lot of fat on the leg.
That's kind of why I was poor at. Question, because I know it's important for the breast to have that fat where that flavor is. I never see legs that are just covered in fat like the breasts are.
No, it isn't. I mean, it kind of looks better and you get a little crispy texture on the outside when you leave the skin on, but you're not going to get much. I mean, there's just no fat in those.
Okay,
legs.
Yeah, that's interesting. I might have to look into that.
And when you're talking about putting them on the barbecue, are you talking about gas, pellet? What is your preferred method?
Camp Chef is one of my sponsors, so I have a lot of free Camp Chef stuff. There was a time when I said, oh, it's got to be real wood, and you know, and I'm not like that anymore. The pellet grills give great flavor. The problem with pellet grills, any of them, is they don't sear.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I love flavoring meat on a pellet grill, but you've got to finish it somewhere else. The Camp Chef pellet grill has a side burner on it, so it either you can either put a flat top, a regular pan. It's got a grill box. It's got a pizza oven that sits on top of it.
Oh, cool!
So you take it from that pellet grill and just put it onto either the flat top or the barbecue box, and then you can get some bark on it that way. But I can use any heat source. It can be in the back of a pickup. It's just a matter of how long you leave it on the flame.
And what's the big difference with using like a cast iron skillet versus something else? And why should someone be using a cast iron over, you know, other skillets per se on like wild game?
I'm a big fan of cast iron. I just don't travel with them for obvious reasons, but that's what I use at home. I just like the way they sear meat mm-hmm. for me. You know, we've kind of lost what blackening fish means. When you go to a restaurant and they say, would you like that blackened or whatever, you go, make it blackened. But blackened used to be, you'd put all these peppers and spices and stuff on the outside. You get a cast iron skillet, leave it on full for about 30 minutes until it's screaming hot. You put that blackened seasoning and it just basically burns it onto the outside. And you want to make sure that the windows are open. You have some ventilation. In my formative years, I remember I was in Alabama cooking for a bunch of doctors, and I was blackening something, and it was kind of low ceiling in the kitchen. The next thing I know, I hear, then the whole room's coughing, and they all go outside because it's like pepper spray to do the blackening part. But if you want to take a duck breast and blacken it, put the blackening seasoning on it, maybe put a little bit of olive oil on it before that, put it into that screaming hot, dry cast iron skillet, and it's going to be black and blue. It's going to be crispy on the outside and rare to medium rare in the center.
Yep.
Might have to try that one. Mm-hmm. Is there any cooking disasters, memorable ones that you've had in your career that actually taught you something valuable after?
The one that I always come back to is I wanted to make a goose loaf, and this was probably, I don't know, 25, 30 years ago. The way I had envisioned it, I had roasted peppers and cheese and herbs and all that, and thinly sliced goose, and I kind of packed it into a loaf pan, thinking that I would bake it and it would set up, and I could slice it like a terrine and it would look really cool, and then put a little sauce on it. It didn't work. There was no binding agent in there. So what happened was once I took it out of the loaf pan, it was just this bloody, gooey mess that just completely fell apart. And I haven't revisited that since. I think it was enough that I didn't want to go back there.
Throughout all your travels, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of stuff that doesn't air. Was there ever a time you're like, I can't believe I'm going to eat this fish or this animal in any dangerous situations and trying to catch that fish or animal? It could be, you know, alligators or whatever it may be.
Well, we were airboating for pythons in the Everglades.
Oh, no, thank you. Thank you.
And you, yeah. Right. You're walking around the Everglades in thigh deep water looking for a 10 to 12 foot python, hoping you don't find one. I did not want to find a python, and we didn't, which was good. But the guy had brought along a live, about a 12 footer. The energy in these things is incredible. They are so ridiculously strong. And then he made python and cheese grits.
Oh, really?
It was horrible. No, it was so bad. And they're really high in mercury. I think one of the comments that I made as I was eating it is I can feel my mercury rising. It's not like rattlesnake. You know, rattlesnake doesn't taste like chicken, of course. I think most of the things that we say taste like chicken, chicken's usually better, I think. But it's with a rattlesnake, I mean, doesn't taste like much. It's a very mild flavor. The python is gross. It's so tough. You can jump up and down on it. You can pound it with a hammer, and it's still going to be really, really hard to chew. And again, I was kind of grateful that we didn't catch one anyway. But python and cheese grits, I'm good just the one time.
Is that something that they like actually were doing all the time and like going out and hunting the pythons and eating them that way, like as a normal activity? Or is it more like, yeah, they're edible, we could do it for the show?
It was for the show.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure. I mean, there's a big python problem in Everglades, and we had heard that, I think there was a New York Times article or something that said pythons are eating their way through the Everglades. They're eating all the fawns. If the dogs are gone and all that, we didn't find that to be the case. And it just happened to be a little cool when we were hunting them, because they like to come out and warm up on the roads at night, since they, you know, they're cold blooded. But we didn't find one. And again, I'm kind of glad we didn't.
But you're just walking out throughout the Everglades, like just hoping to come and, all right.
There is the guy with the airboat. He said he knew where to look for them. That's what he does.
Yeah.
But that's it. You're just wading through the swamp. And there's gators everywhere, and you're thinking, wow, why am I here?
Well, that's where I feel like we're fortunate out here. We don't have alligators. We don't have big snakes. It's like, I don't know if I would be a huge outdoorsman if I was in a place like that, because I'd be like, no, I'm good. I'm not sending my dog out to go get some stuff in the decoys, you know,
right.
And hopefully an alligator comes up next to it and wants the duck too, you know?
Yeah,
you want to avoid Louisiana then, for sure. We'll be there in February for the Nutria Roundup, Nutria Rodeo.
Oh.
So, and you know, we've got Nutria in the Delta now.
I heard they're not bad eating.
They're fine. They're vegetarians.
Yeah.
But they have to let us kill these Nutria. I know we can't shoot them here, last I heard. The problem is they eat all the vegetation on the levees, and it compromises the levees. And bad things happen. In Louisiana, if you're a resident, you bring in the last 7 inches of tail, and they give you $5 a tail. So guys would go out and shoot 100 of them, leave the bodies for the gators to eat, and then collect money on the tails. And for the Nutria Rodeo that will be there, they do Nutria Toss. They bring, there are literal bucket or truckloads of Nutria that they're bringing in.
Wow. That's a yearly, annual, like it's a thing.
It's an annual, yeah. That's.
Have you been down there before?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
What's the most common Nutria preparation that they do?
You know, I cooked it kind of like pulled pork.
Oh, yeah.
Cooked it slow, wrapped it in barbecue sauce, or with foil and some barbecue sauce, until you could just pretty much pull the meat apart. It tasted like pulled pork.
Huh. Interesting. Yeah, I think people
try that one.
Get over that mind game of like it's a giant rat. It's just
it is a giant rat. Yeah.
If you look at it as meat, if I'm all for it, if it tastes good and the texture's fine, I'll eat it. I don't care what it is.
Right. Yeah. Ugly animals taste good too, and it's got these two orange teeth right in front too, which you know.
Yeah, I'm all for it.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if I could do that.
You've got the mental block.
Maybe. Yeah. Yeah. I might have the mental block on that one, like eating a possum or something. Probably. I don't know.
Well, and you know, there's people that tell me that possum's really good, and possum's not good. Possum, you know, raccoon is dark and stringy, you know, and a lot of it is in the South where people talk about, I love possum, I love, you know, they eat a lot of squirrel brains there, and I talked to a physician there that said the chronic wasting is mostly in the South is coming from people eating the squirrel brains.
Oh, that's interesting. So,
how are they cooking the squirrel and eating the brains? Like, that just doesn't sound...
Well, it's in the South. It's in the South. They're going to fry it. They'll bread it and fry it.
Yeah.
Everything's fried. Huh.
That's wild. I would never even, like, think to do that.
You know, and I'm not...
Yeah, who started that one?
I'm not a big organ guy anyway. I know that everybody, you know, they go nuts about deer hearts and all that. And I'm just... I'm not a liver guy. I'm not a brain guy.
Is it tough being kind of a renowned chef and you go somewhere and somebody goes, oh, I'm going to serve you liver. And you're like, oh God, not again. Like, is that tough for you?
Well, I just had that. We've got this new series called Jason the Butcher about this guy. He has survival camps. He teaches special ops how to survive in the wild. They killed animals all week. And then he made a big stew with all the organ parts. And it was, you know, it was cow and sheep and goat liver. Yeah. And it was on camera. So I told him, I said, I don't like this. So, one of the things, you don't want to offend people that are doing nice things for you. Like the guy, the people that made the machita, the goat thing. what I normally will do is people that watch the show regularly, I'll just kind of give a side glance and put an eyebrow up, and they'll know that I didn't like it. But you don't want to, you know, somebody just made a pot of whatever for you. You don't want to go, geez, this sucks. Yeah. But a lot of it does.
Was there ever an item that like you got really sick on after someone else cooked it for you, or you cooked it yourself and just either underprepared it or just didn't agree with you?
Well, we were duck hunting in Mexico, and the night before, I'm with a tourism guy and we're eating street vendor food in downtown Mazatlan. So the camera guys watch as they take the lid off this pot and all these flies come out.
Oh.
And then they're serving me oysters and uncooked shrimp and things like that. And so we had to shoot a few more ducks for the show on the way to the airport the next morning. And, you know, when you're duck hunting in Mexico, at least where we were, you're wearing shorts and a T-shirt. And, you know, you could have a propeller on your head and the ducks aren't going to flare. I'm not quite sure how to put this, but I was doing a stand-up on camera and the oysters kicked in. And when I say kicked in, they kicked out. And somebody thought I was blowing a mallard call, and that's I'm not making that up. And so I go to the van driver and I say, "Man, do you have any paper, papeles, anything?" Nothing. So I had to use whatever clothes I had, and they're somewhere in Mazatlan.
Still in Mexico.
The outskirts of Mazatlan. Oh, so yes, man. That's the worst so far. And I've had a few oyster episodes, but it's still one of my favorite foods.
Okay. Well, that's a good that you go back to it.
Yeah.
As besides the hagfish that you talked about, is there any animal that's super challenging that you think people, you know, kind of steer away from cooking, or that you've cooked that's challenging to cook, but is not out of the ordinary like a hagfish?
You know, we've done a lot in Florida. We just did a fish called a clown knife fish.
I've seen those, yeah.
Yeah, they're tropical fish, right? Mm-hmm. That in Florida, everything started out as a tropical fish, and now it's in their waterways. They're really, really hard to clean, and they've got dark meat up top, lighter meat on the bottom. The bone structure is a little awkward. Snake heads are another one. Snake heads, the other exotic fish there. They taste really, really good. They're great fighters. They don't die easy. I buried a butcher knife into his head, and he's looking at me like, "Is that all you got?" You know, it's just some things are easier to clean. You know, you've got pike, muskie that have the Y bone in there that a lot of people don't want to mess with too. You know, anything else, you know, like birds, I'm more of a bird hunter than anything. If it's me hunting, I'm not shooting a four-legged animal. I do that for TV. But there's nothing easier to clean than a bird.
Yeah.
It's just so much, so little time compared to a big deer or an elk.
You'd mentioned that you've had beaver tail. That seemed like there was kind of a staple with the hunters and trappers back in the day, getting pelts, and then they would eat the beaver tail. I mean, what does that taste like? Is it like super gritty, greasy tasting? Or like,
no,
what
it's
is it?
Fatty.
It's fatty.
It's fatty. You take the tail and you put it over an open flame and blacken it like you would with bell peppers and blister it on the outside. Then you scrape the burnt stuff off, chunk it up, and make stew out of it. It's really, really tender. It's fatty. I would have expected it to be tough as nails.
Yeah.
But it was not. It was really good.
That's cool. Yeah. Because some of those books that we've read, they talk about, you know, eating beaver tail and all that. But I was always curious about how they actually cooked it and prepared it.
Right.
That makes sense. Probably cooking it right over a fire.
You don't want an undercooked beaver either, because there's the trichinosis thing with that. So the when you're cooking the other parts, you want to cook it to a safe temperature.
We were talking about that earlier with pigs and bear, because the previous podcast we had somebody here that was just given some bear, and Jeff was saying, "Well, I don't know if I'd eat it because it's a bear and trichinosis." I said, "Well, you eat wild pig," and he says, "Well, it's a pig."
So. I love wild pig. It tastes so good. I just really enjoy the meat, and it doesn't bother me. But I guess the thing with the bear is like, there's no offense to anyone that shoots bears. I could care less. I just don't have any desire to go shoot one. So that's probably
what
I
said. But I have no desire. Like,
well, if jerky, but if there's jerky. Like, here's some deer, here's some bear steaks, I'd probably be like, yeah, I'm good. Yeah.
Well, and I know a lot of people that render their bear down and they use the grease to bake with and things. Yeah. Now, I've had good bear and I've had really bad rank rancid bear.
Yeah.
We shot for the show, we shot about a 440-pound bear in Minnesota. And these guys cooked the bear liver for me. And as I mentioned, I'm not an organ guy anyway. The bear liver tasted like a wet, meaty sponge.
Yeah.
Yep. Sounds about right.
And then I read in the Minnesota DNR, it said, whatever you do, don't eat the bear liver. It has toxic levels of B vitamins. So, you know, lesson learned, do your homework before you eat the bear liver.
Got to read up on those regs prior to
We were working.
What are your three go-to ingredients that you normally will use on Cooking Wild Game?
Salt, pepper, olive oil.
Yeah. Simple, I mean, right? It's so simple. And I used to think like marinating the duck for 2 days. And then putting it on the grill, sloshing some more stuff on there, and it was not good. And then just doing stuff.
And that's kind of the common thing that I mentioned earlier is people really try and make their ducks not taste like ducks.
Yeah.
And if they just would make sure they, you know, they take care of it in the field, put a little brine on it, and don't overcook it, they'll find that they have a whole new duck. It's like with dove season. I think the reason why the dove poppers are so popular is if you overcook a dove even a little bit, it's a different piece of meat than if you cook it medium rare. Mm-hmm. You know, a fully cooked dove breast to me has a gamey flavor that a properly cooked dove breast that you just cooked to medium rare, it doesn't taste like that. But if you marinate it, especially if you use something like a potent marinade, like a teriyaki or whatever, you won't know the difference. It makes it more forgiving, but just don't cook it so long. You know, people that it's been really rewarding for me working consumer shows across the country where I would eat a piece of duck and I'd serve people duck and they'd say, wow, what did you do to make it so tender? And I said, nothing. Here's the raw piece of duck, salt and pepper. Try this. Here's how it's cooked.
Yeah.
And they're thinking I use some kind of tenderizer or something else. I'm going, no, I just didn't cook it so long. When I go back the next year and the same people say, I don't give my ducks away anymore. Now that I basically gave them permission to not cook them so long. To me, that's a real victory. If people, you know, they don't, if you've got a recipe that's two or three pages, you're not going to do it anyway. I mean, there's some foodies out there that'll deal with that crap, but I'm not one of them. I use, you know, seasonal vegetables. You know, I don't use tomatoes in January, and it's a little depressing because I'm a big homegrown tomato guy. So I go to the farmer's market in Folsom, and we're about out of tomatoes. I'm surprised they lasted this long. But just because you can get a tomato in January or a nectarine in January doesn't mean you should. Use fresh produce in season. Don't overcook it. And it's a whole different animal.
Yeah, yeah, I agree on that.
I think it's a huge hurdle that we see for newer hunters. You know, how do we cook this? I did a duck camp this weekend. We had 13 brand new duck hunters there. And that's what I harped them with is you can screw this up very, very easily and you will not like the taste of it. But if you do it right, you won't be able to eat anything else because this is all you're going to want. But there's a fine line between overdoing it, and you can't really underdo it, but just that line is right there. And if you go over, you know you went over.
Yeah.
And I would eat a slice of either raw duck or raw deer just to prove a point before I did it, and people would completely freak out. But really, nothing dies at medium rare anyway. And what I would do to illustrate that is you cut a duck breast in half and you cook half of it medium rare and half of it well done and say, same duck breast, now try this one, try that one. It's two completely different pieces of meat.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's actually a good idea. I should do that.
Yeah, well, I think it's just getting over that mindset because people think like, oh, wild game, like you have to overcook it to kill everything. Yeah,
there's like, so much nasty stuff in there.
It's yeah, like, I mean, right. Like, I probably grew up like that, you know, and it's like now you look at all the stuff that you used to cook and you're like, how did I even eat some of that stuff, you know?
Just
like,
well, I mean,
charred breasts.
A duck that's flown back and forth from Canada a couple times, to me, is a much healthier animal than a six-week-old chicken that's been raised in a shoebox.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
So what do you think? I mean, most people, if it's diver ducks, spoonies, whatever, what's your personal opinion on duck species and how they taste, et cetera? And what would you do with different types of ducks?
Well, you know, we did a shoot with Melinda Dodds in, and you know, surf scoters. Scoters right. aren't known for being good table fare. I took scoters, and I mean, their fat is orange.
Yeah, they're so hard to clean. So the first thing I did,
remove the fat, brine them, cook the medium rare, did a little balsamic reduction thing on there, and they tasted me just like most ducks.
Yeah.
The darker diver, you know, the darker the duck to me requires a little bit more work. Sea ducks, divers, I'm not opposed to putting a little marinade on those after I brine them. And the skin's got to come off on those too. I find in the darker ducks, the skin's not going to help. I serve spoonies to people all the time. I just don't tell them they're spoonies and there's no complaints.
Mm-hmm.
We shot spoonies in the Salton Sea. If you're familiar with the Salton Sea, which is like the hills have eyes. It's just a freak show. It's a resort. It's twice the size of Tahoe. Nothing lives in this water, but we ate the spoonies and they tasted just fine.
Fat off or on those?
Fat off. When in doubt, if the water's questionable, if the color doesn't look right, you know, and if I see a piece of meat that's, I don't eat green meat in general. I don't marinate that to get the green off it. But you know, if you've got freezer burn or something on a piece of meat, you can usually cut that off and cook around it. It's just fine. You know, there's always chili, stew, sausage, summer sausage. You take diver ducks and you put about 30% fat in there, grind the whole thing up. Don't even tell anybody they're divers. They'll be fine if you're making sausage.
Yeah. We had a guy at an event a number of years ago. He was a Marine and they shot a bunch of coots at Camp Pendleton and it made jalapeno cheese sausage. And yeah, everyone's just going to town on it, right? Oh, this is the best thing ever. Oh, thank you so much. This guy's been raving about it for half an hour. And I was like, you know, those are all coots, right? And he like almost turned green. I was like, you've been raving about it for a half hour. You just had no idea what they were. That's the same product. You know what I mean? But it is funny. Right. People get it in their head, right? So.
Well, and we did, in the Delta, we did a show with coots, and we were in a bass boat so that it looked, you know, there it just kind of looked like we were floating into them while we were bass fishing. And we weren't, it wasn't an American Sportsman deal. We just wanted meat to cook. And so we slaughtered the coots. We brought them to Giusti's in Walnut Grove. They made coot cacciatore. And I served it to guys at the bar, people in the dining room. And these are hunters and farmers that I know would have loved to say, Scott, this really sucks. Why did you do this? You suck. They said, this is incredible. They loved the coot cacciatore. I haven't cooked a coot since because, you know, I'm not going after coots in general. But if everything goes south and you need to eat, go out and shoot 25 of those and stock your freezer. They taste fine.
Yep. Scott, can you brief us on a little bit of some of the other shows that you're involved with and what you guys have coming out soon?
Well, we've got a show called The Fishmonger, which is about the commercial fishing industry with a buddy of mine, Tommy Gomes, fourth generation commercial fisherman. We go all over the country showing the challenges with the commercial fishing industry and how, you know, 90% of the seafood that we eat in this country is imported. You take shrimp, for instance, 90%+ of the shrimp that we eat is imported, and about 1% of that is inspected. Most of it's coming out of India and Southeast Asia.
Oh, wow.
We're encouraging people to buy American-caught anything. And based on the success of that show, we have another one called Ranch America that's hosted by River Class. I was looking for a host. I was introduced to him and his wife. He has a restaurant up in Murphy's. He has a couple of them. He's got Grounds and Firewood. And he's also a cattle rancher. And he looks like it. He wears a cowboy hat, good-looking guy, well-spoken. And I was up there, and I looked at my wife, and I said, I think I just found the host of the Ranch America show. And then Jason the Butcher is this guy that, you know, teaches special ops how to survive in the wild. And then we've got Dead Meat, which is the show that I still host until they tell me I can't anymore. And I believe we have a fifth series that will start in 26 called Meet Joe Wilson. Joe Wilson is this guy. He's very colorful, active. He's Central Coast, California born, now lives in Bentonville, Arkansas, and sounds like an Arkansas redneck, has the mustache, the cowboy hat, looks like it. When Bizarre Foods came to Bentonville and they were asking who they should talk to, they said, well, you got to talk to Joe Wilson. Joe Wilson said, yeah, we've got the World Championship Squirrel Festival right here, Squirrel Cook-Off right here in Bentonville. And they said, well, we'll have to come back for that. Well, when are you going to do that? And he said, well, it'll be a few weeks. He was lying about the whole thing. He made the whole thing up. So he had to put together the World Champion Squirrel Cook-Off in a couple weeks.
No way.
It's now gotten so big. When we were there, they had a team from the Netherlands. They come from all over the world.
That's to the World hilarious. Championship
Squirrel Cook-Off. So that's the kind of thing that Joe does. I'm not interested in producing a bass fishing or deer hunting show. It doesn't entertain me. We like personality driven shows. You know, we're up in the Dakotas while we're doing the ranching show. We're also shooting prairie dogs and sharp tails and all that kind of good stuff too. So, that's what we have so far. I'm trying to stay home, but I've got other people that want to keep working that are a lot younger than me.
You got a lot going on, and we appreciate you coming on today. We've got one last question. You are a world-renowned wild game chef. Is it true that your wife does not prefer wild game?
Well, you know, I used to be able to lie to her and not tell her. I was doing a photo. I was doing a venison bulgogi. It's a Korean barbecue type of preparation. Yep. And I had just done the plate. I was doing it for a Winchester online thing or whatever. And I had just done the plate presentation. My wife comes home from work. She says, what are you doing? I said, well, it's supposed to be a venison dish, but I didn't have any venison, so I used beef. Looks the same in the photo. She takes it out on the patio. I go out. She has one piece left. And I said, nah, that's deer meat. So she pushes her plate away and says, you lied to me. I said, well, of course I lied to you. You wouldn't have eaten it if I hadn't lied to you. And you said you loved it. She goes, I don't care. You lied to me. So it's just a thing. You know, not everybody wants to eat Bambi. I don't have a problem with it. It's normally a mental thing, because when they eat it, they go, oh yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
And then they don't eat it again. I don't know if your guys' wives or girlfriends or whoever eat what you bring home, but my wife doesn't. It's a little annoying.
Yeah. My wife's good on the ducks, but like, antelope or anything like that, she's like, that looks good. If it's jerky, she will eat that. But
right.
Same thing. Mindset, venison does not want to eat it, but ducks, fine. Totally fine. And right. I'm grateful for that, right? But are you?
She doesn't prefer it, but she'll eat it.
Yeah, that's good.
She won't go hunting, but she knows what I do. So, yeah,
but eating it wise.
Eating it wise, yeah, she'll eat it.
Yeah.
Not, but like I said, won't ask for it.
Right. So, well, Scott, you want to leave us with any of your final thoughts?
Man, you know, I appreciate that I've been able to do what I've been able to do all my life. I mean, as much as I'm ready to stay home now and hang up my chef's knife, you know, getting out there is a lot better than talking to you guys on the laptop. But really, the cooking, if you don't like the way your duck tastes, don't blame the duck. Try brining. Don't overcooking. Just take a bite. Take 30 seconds out of your life and try it cooked a little bit differently. The worst thing that could happen is you spit it out and don't do it again. But really, try that rare to medium rare duck. If you don't like gamey flavors, I don't like gamey, right? I don't like liver. When people say that duck tastes like liver, I know it's not the duck.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Amen to that.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate you coming on today, Scott.
Yeah. All right, guys. We appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, Scott. So right. Scott Lasath with the Sporting Chef and signing off. Thanks, Scott. Appreciate you.
Bye. You got it.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Save It for the Blind podcast. You can find our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.